Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. Today's guest is prolific author Marijana Stavison. In this interview, we chat about her writing process and her books. Now let's go to the interview.
Hi, Marijana. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. What pandemic? We're having fun. It's fine. Okay. I had to get that out of my system.
I know. We're in the midst of pandemic.
There we go. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an Air Force brat. And so I've lived all over the world by the time I was 12. And rather than pay attention in school, I would write short stories, which explains being prolific and also my C+ average. And I didn't go to college, so I always try to tell high schools will occasionally invite me to come and speak. And I'm like, you understand, I did not go to college. I did not pay attention in high school, and it worked out great for me. So if you're prepared for your children to hear this, I'm on board. And then I've had a whole bunch of weird jobs. I was a medical test subject for a while. I was a model for a few years. And somewhere along the way, met my husband, had a couple kids, started getting published, and here we are.
I love it. So what inspired you to become a writer?
Honestly, being the new kid was a lot to do with it. The fourth or fifth or sixth time your mom says, hey, you know how we didn't think we were going to move again? We're moving again. And after a while, I just stopped trying to make friends. And because it was just so painful. Some of your younger subscribers aren't going to understand this, but this was a time before social media, Facebook. I had to get out a piece of paper and write a letter to my friends and then find a stamp and then mail it if I wanted to keep in touch with anyone I had left behind when we moved. And what 12-year-old is going to do any of that? Mm-hmm. So by the time I was in high school, I just kept my head down and wrote stories. And my mom had said to me, listen, you're a freshman now in high school, and we're not moving again until you graduate. And I politely called her a dirty, rotten liar. And so I would keep my head down and write. And after a while, some kids were coming up to me and saying, what are you always writing during class? And I'm like, oh, short stories, whatever. Oh, can I see? Yeah, whatever. I don't care. I'm leaving in a month. As it turned out, my mom was right. We never did move again before I finished high school. And then all these kids started reading my stories, and they would wait for me at my locker in the morning and say, what happens next? And I got completely hooked, not just the sheer joy of writing, but just people saying, I need to know what happens next. And I just, it was from 13 on, I knew I was going to write. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And that, there's that hokey saying, when you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. It's true. I had the best job ever. It's insanely. I get to send emails to my editor with the word asshat in the subject line. I mean, how great is that? I just found out from my agent, they're looking into the gaming rights to two of my series, the gaming rights. I'm just like, wow, okay, that's interesting. So my Fred the Mermaid trilogy and my Alaskan trilogy might be turned into games.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, how awesome and weird is that? And slightly ridiculous. So I, even when there isn't a pandemic, I just count my blessings every single day. I'm so, so fortunate. And I love my work and I love my readers.
I love it. I love it so much. So what was your journey to get your first book published?
Well, it's funny because I got for 10 years, I got rejection slips. For 10 years, I could have redone my dining room in rejection because some of those rejection letters were on that nice, heavy bond paper, classy stuff as they break your heart and crush your dreams. So for 10 years, I got rejection slips. And then I finally said, you know what? I'm done trying to break into New York publishing. There are these little ebook publishers popping up, and I'm just going to try one of them. And so one of them bought Undead and Unwed. And I didn't know it at the time, but New York Publishing was actually starting to pay attention to e-publishers. Now, at that time, you had two choices. You could read the e-book on your computer, or you could print it out and read it on paper. And nobody wanted to do that. So it was just considered this fringe thing that was not going to take off. So when Undead and Unwed came out as an ebook, my Berkeley editor saw it, told her assistant, buy that, download it, give me the printout, I'm going to read it. And she called me a week later and asked for the print rights. So just like that, I had a 3-book contract with Berkeley Romance because I had gone the ebook route.
Oh my God.
Whereas now, you know, all the, you know, 12, 15 years later, no one thinks anything of, there are plenty of books that only come out as a Kindle or as a, which is, I think is wonderful. I want readers to be able to read my stuff in any medium they want, recorded, ebook, tattooed on their body, whatever they want. That's what I want to do for them. So I just love now how the market's opened up even more. And it actually reminds me of back in the day, this is even before my day. Once upon a time, paperbacks were considered complete crap that would never, ever last. And anything that wasn't a hardcover book didn't count as a real book. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, that was a few decades ago.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, it's just amazing to me how the market keeps changing and evolving. And I just think it's wonderful.
Okay. And so you publish from multiple publishers?
I do, yes.
So what is that process like? You're selling
that process is very much polite juggling. Okay. Because St. Martin's Press doesn't want to hear me say, hey, can I put my deadline off a month? Because Sourcebooks really needs their book, like, in a rush. I mean, I don't even have to tell you how crazy the schedule is. Hello. So I have to be very careful when I'm scheduling things. And but I really love it. And, you know, I don't come from any money. I was an Air Force brat. And, you know, my mom worked at McDonald's, you know, for a few years to help me. And so part of working for extra publishers is just my irrational fear of having all my eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't have to do that anymore. But now I'm used to it. It's the way I like to do. And it keeps me from getting blocked. If I'm blocked on my Tropes trilogy, The Love Scam, I can flip over to Bears Behaving Badly, which is a completely different subgenre. So I definitely think that helps me keep from getting blocked. But yeah, you have to be careful scheduling. You have to be very, very tactful, because one editor does not want to hear about how swamped the other editor is. They don't care, and they shouldn't care. It's had nothing to do with them. Mm-hmm. So keep on top of your schedule, be polite, and it can absolutely be done. And again, really good problems to have. You know, oh no, I'm juggling 4 publishers. Do you want to hear my tale of woe, or do you want me to tell me to just shut up and write? Because I'm going to go for the latter.
Yep, just right.
Shut up and write, Mary Janice. That's right. I should tattoo that on my chest. But in like reverse letters, so when I'm standing in front of the mirror, I could be like, yeah, shut up and write, Mary Janice. I'll put that on my to-do list.
So let's talk about your writing. Do you follow an outline, or are you a pantser?
I am a pantser. I must be cornered like a rat. Outlining, I will do a few paragraphs. I'll do a page. And often when I'm halfway through the book, I will come to a realization, or I'll think of a much better plot twist, and that the outline is abandoned. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot. But in today's publishing, many editors just aren't comfortable signing a new contract, or, you know, unless they have like something to look at, mm-hmm. which I think is a little absurd, because I've had editors say, just write it's fine if you totally deviate, just give me one page to bring into the sales meeting. And often a year later, that one page doesn't resemble anything like the finished book. But that's, you know what, that's for them to worry about and not for me to worry about. So at most I'll do a page, but virtually all of my books start with an idea. For example, Undead and Unwed. What if an ordinary administrative assistant became the queen of the vampires? You know, what if, you know, sleeping with the fishes? What if what if there was a grumpy mermaid who couldn't swim and didn't like fish? So, and then there'll be a whole book written around that. In the case of the Undead books, an entire 15 book series written around that. And then of course, for the Love Scam trilogy, how many romance tropes can we put in a romance novel for fun? It was actually my editor's idea. I just thought it was such a clever idea. And so off we go to the races.
Yep, I love it. And I love plus gifts.
There's a list too. There's a list of tropes at the end. So I really shouldn't be telling readers this. So if you want to just flip to the end, you can look up and see if the romance tropes you like are represented in this book. So, but that was just so fun. And I'm just delighted to be promoting it now. And I can't wait for readers to read it, because we all love romance. And what brings us back again and again are the tropes. And I just thought that was a great idea. And my editor let me run with it.
Love it. I'm so glad your editor let you run with it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm 6 feet tall. And so they know to just get out of the way. I'm 6 feet tall and I'm clumsy. So they know to just stay or keep their distance, or I will accidentally fall on them and yell.
Very upsetting. All right. So you're writing multiple books at a time and you're all these different things. So how do you organize your ideas, your characters, your
spreadsheets?
Okay.
Yep. Spreadsheets, columns, and it's just easier, you know, to keep things straight. And it's fun because it's a tool. I think a lot of writers do this. It's a tool we can use and we don't want to write, but we want to feel like we're being productive. So I'm like, you know what? I need to reorganize my spreadsheet and update it. Blah, 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 blah. Are you working? Yeah. So yeah, I honestly, just columns and spreadsheets. I have a spreadsheet per book and you can just see everything at a glance. And with it's 2020 and there's so many wonderful, you know, software packages, or you don't even need anything fancy. I use Word and Excel, but you can't, there are plenty of software packages out there that will make it just so easy for you. But again, I think sometimes it can be a time suck. You know, if we don't want to create, but we want to feel like we're doing stuff.
Yeah.
That's why I went to England to research contemporary asset. I'm like, this is work. Come on, sweetie. Let's go to the Tower of London. Work. Let's go to Hever Castle for work.
It's all work. It's all related.
What a fun trip. Oh.
Going down the research trip, like down rabbit hole of just like on Wikipedia, going down the different things. It's like, it's work.
Oh, it kidnaps you. It grabs your TVTropes.com. Oh my, I have lost days of my life to TV tropes. And I found it entirely by accident. And what's humbling is, and any trope you want is there, any trope at all. And what's humbling is I would think of an idea and I would go to TV tropes and I would plug it in. And it's really humbling to look at the result and say, oh, 79 other writers had this idea and 72 of them did it better than I did. So that could be a little humbling.
Oh my gosh.
it was so cool that, you know, my heroine's eyes change color, you know, and you just think it's this incredibly original idea and you find out 400 other writers had it before you did. Don't.
Yeah. Oh no. So you share your work along the way or for others to read, or do you wait till it's completed?
I will occasionally tease with a chapter, but 99% of the time, it would be almost a mistake to share too much of it, because when I share too much of it, then I don't want to finish it.
Interesting.
Well, to talk about Twilight for a second, she's got a new book coming out and it's from the point of view of Edward Cullen. Well, about 10 years ago, she was working on that book and a bunch of it got leaked online, like half of it, and a ton of people read it. And she got understandably angry and she said, you know what, screw this. I'm not going to do this book now. And she yanked it out of the publishing line and it never came out. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand why Stephanie Meyer would be completely angry about that and feel very violated. I completely lost my train of thought. That's understandable and I don't blame her. And it's nice that now she's doing the book again. Mm-hmm. But I can completely understand so many people have read so much of it. What's the point now? And that's kind of how I feel about sharing stuff online. I will, at the most, I will share a chapter just as a tease.
Yeah.
I am a tease. I will fully own being a big fat tease.
I think the teas are helpful. I think it's
somewhat. Oh, yeah.
I personally don't like excerpts. Like, I like to read the whole story. So just like, if the tease happens, and I'm like, I have to wait. Like, this is horrible.
Oh, yeah. So, well, and you know, that's why we have flap copy on the back of books, you know, to haul you in, to hook you and then land you and then fillet you and cook you and eat you. Yeah, I had to follow that metaphor to its logical conclusion, and now I regret it badly. I promise not to cook and eat you.
This is awesome. Okay, so let's start with the love scan. What was the source of inspiration? You talked a little bit about the tropes, but what other... What was the story?
It's going to sound crazy. My inspiration was Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. Those are Simon Pegg movies. And when you watch them, you can see the writer's love for the genre. Mm-hmm. They even tweaked it in the Hot Fuzz poster. You know, the producers of this movie watched a lot of action movies to get ready. And so it was making fun of the genre, but not in a mean way. It was, they were just having so much fun with it. Shaun of the Dead, you know, somebody had to kill, you know, his mom. You know, some people have to do this. You get cornered here and you have to do that. And those are all tropes found in every zombie movie. And they just found this fun way to do it. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to do a romance novel where it's the exact same thing. It's showing pure love for the genre, cramming all these tropes in there, but not in a disrespectful way. At no point did Shaun of the Dead make fun of people who like zombie movies, and at no point do my books make fun of romance lovers. Mm-hmm. So my editor thought it was a great idea. I thought it was a great idea. And the next thing I knew, I had a contract for a trilogy.
I love it. So let's talk about Love Scam. So the book is set in Venice, and this is Italian language. So what was your research like to get this book? You know, get the Italian language, get the Venice.
I went to Venice. Okay. Again, see earlier in this podcast, my ridiculously fortunate and wonderful life. Yeah. My husband and I went to Italy.
Okay.
And we went to a lot of places that are in the Love Scam. We went to Lake Como. We went to Venice. And it was incredible. There's no city like Venice in the world. And not to bring everybody down with the pandemic again, but it's amazing to me to hear all these stories about how fish are showing up in the canals again, because, you know, we've taken a break from polluting everything we see.
Yeah.
A forced break, but it's still a break from polluting everything we see. But it was incredible. And all I could think was, what if you woke up in this incredible city with no idea how you got there? And that's exactly what happens to my hero, Rafe. He comes to in Venice, Italy. It's not even, he has no idea how he ended up there. And the entire book is him figuring that out and kind of being his own detective. And there's a lost child in the mix. And it was so fun. And one of the things I make him do with the poor guy is for now. And one thing that struck me about Venice is how everybody says, don't touch the water. We understand that this is a city surrounded by water. Don't touch any of it. Honestly, don't even look at it. It's very dangerous and bad for you. So I, being a stupid American, I'm like, why? So like you would get sick if you drank some of it. And they're like, don't drink it either. For the love of God, don't drink it. Don't go near it. Try not to touch it. Try not to think about it. And I'm just like, okay. So it's a smidge polluted down there. But it doesn't take away from the pure glory of that city. And you just, I live in Minnesota, which is not an old state. Boston, I loved living in Boston because every day I walked by Benjamin Franklin's tombstone on my way to work. Mm. And when you go over to Europe, you see just how young America is. Mm. And you're looking at these buildings that are, it's not even five, but you're looking at 800, 900, 1,000-year-old buildings. It's part of the reason why I loved going to England so much to research contemporary asshat. You're standing in a spot where Henry VIII literally stood. You know, you're only separated from these immense historical figures by time, not time and space. And to me, that is incredible. And I try to put that in my work.
I love it. Yeah, I think I just love the fact that it was set in Venice. And like, it just reminded me of how smelly the city is, you know.
Well, and what I pointed out to my editor was like, hey, you know, we're going to do some PR and we've got this, you know, wonderful podcast lady set up and everything. And I said, well, you know, and if you, the Love Scam, if you're still on lockdown in August and you read the Love Scam, you get to see Venice, you get to see Lake Como, you get to see Paris. you get to see Vegas, for $5, you can take a trip with your imagination. And I know that sounds hokey, but it's also completely true. It's why we love books. Yeah. You know, I don't read books about Midwestern writers who never leave their house. How boring. I read books about hunks who wake up in Venice and have no idea where their underwear is.
Yep. And then they fall in the lake.
They fall in a filthy, disgusting canal and almost die. And it's terrific. And everybody has fun.
Yeah. It was a fun, like, little, like, kind of, like, shock to the snow. He's like, I'm just walking. Oh, fall in the canal.
Well, it didn't help that he was, because I had to be careful, because they actually do make it difficult for you to fall into the canal. Yeah. So, which is why he's so very hungover in the beginning. Yeah. He doesn't know where he is. And we've all had a paralyzing hangover at some point in our lives, or 10 in my case, or 50. And so when your head is pounding and your stomach's upset and you're hot and you're gross and you're wearing old clothes and all you're thinking about is getting something non-alcoholic to drink and getting out of the sun. So it was inevitable that he was going to plummet into the canal, but it just caused all kinds of, he loses his phone in the canal. I mean, just, it causes all kinds of more problems, which was all part of my diabolical plan. I will not deny wanting to torture Rake Tarbell.
I love it so much. So let's talk about Ray. So he's quirky. He's a man child. I think he grows up in this book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, he had an interesting relationship with his twin brother. He loves him. He hates him.
He
had the nuclear option of the grandfather. Like, he basically has to grow up. And he realizes that he may have a child or not. So it wasn't important to show this character arc in the story.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you have to. Who wants to read about a hero who doesn't grow and doesn't learn anything?
Yeah.
You can just, go out on the street in real life and randomly pick random people. Hey, have you learned from all your mistakes? No. Oh, okay. Yeah. And Rake is charming, and he is a rake, and he's wealthy, but the Tarbells are a little like me in that when they were younger, they had no money at all. Their mother supported them as a waitress in Las Vegas, raised twin boys on her own. And they didn't find out, their father, who they never met, died when the twins were 12, and then they inherited millions. So overnight, literally overnight, they went from scrambling and sewing up their own rips in their pants, all the stuff that I had to do as a kid, to almost unimaginable wealth. Mm-hmm. Fast forward a few years, and Rake's taking that for granted. He's being a playboy. He's kind of forgotten, that most people in the world do not have that privilege, don't live that life. And a lot of the love scam is about kind of waking him up to how careless and even selfish that he's been. I mean, he's very likable. He's very charming. He's a typical rogue, but he's got stuff to learn, and he needs to learn. And that's basically the setup for the love scam. Heroine, by contrast, orphaned at a young age, never got a break ever. And so at first she's physically attracted to him, but she's a little disgusted by him too. Like, oh, poor you. Did you lose your Black American Express card in the canal? Pardon me while I weep fake tears for you, asshat.
Yes.
So there's definitely a journey here. And just like the journey that Rake's twin Blake takes. In the first book in this trilogy. And then the third and final book, which is coming out this fall, is so they're all kind of tenuously connected, and they all give service to romance tropes. But they have journeys and they have to learn, it's evolution, learn or die. That's how it is.
I got a question, and this is something that I felt that was unique. All the footnotes, which is probably research rabbit holes that you just went through, and all the language, like the German and the Italian. What
what is goes through your mind when you spit out all this stuff onto the page? Nothing goes through my mind. You should see the footnotes before my editor starts saying, we don't need this one, we don't need this one, we don't need this one. It's stuff I find out when I'm researching, and I just feel like my readers will also get a kick out of it. I've been very, I also, the same thing with my author note in the beginning of the book. And I've had, I have readers who say, you write the funniest author notes I've ever seen in my life. I've had readers say, I bought your book because of the author's note. I had no idea what the book was about. Mm-hmm. But so, and the same with the footnotes. I just think it's, I get to research all this cool stuff. And I'm so fortunate, and I want to share some of that with my readers. Like, all of my books are riddled with footnotes. They're all and they're. I'm a foodie. I was a foodie before it was trendy. So when my characters eat at a restaurant, if I make it a restaurant I have been to, and I always put that in the reader's notes. Like, if you want to go to Pazza Luna, which is in one of my books, you absolutely can, and I strongly advise you to get the trout. So it's just kind of my way of drawing the readers into my world and my research, and just sharing with them the stuff that I got to find out.
I love it. All right, so let's talk about the nuclear option, which I think is just like, you would think, when you think about family, you think about, you know, you always have that nuclear option that can actually make, you know, be the godsend manipulator who's like having all the pieces together. What was it important to show the family that loves yet metals in other people's lives? Like,
When I was reading over your list of questions, I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful question. I actually couldn't wait for you to get to it. Because if the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference.
Yeah.
And these people meddle for love. I mean, it's annoying, and it can be incredibly inconvenient and honestly, in some cases, dangerous. but yeah, so the nuclear option meddles for love. She sees that, you know, things aren't right with her grandson, and she wants to try and fix it rather than sit down and have a talk like an adult. Yeah. She'll be moving behind the scenes. Well, there's not much of a book of people sit down and have face-to-face conversations immediately and get everything straightened out at the end. That's like a 12-page book. Yawn. I can't charge $4.99 for that. I have to drag things out. People can't talk to each other. Don't be ridiculous. Anyway, so it's absolutely, and I think, and I've not to this extent, but we all have a loved one in our life who wanted to help us and then went about it entirely the wrong way. Now, do you get mad at them? Maybe a little, but do you understand that if they didn't care, they would never have lifted a finger? And I think that's really important to show that, because meddling means love. It really does.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's just a unique, they have a unique relationship, because yeah. She was not present at the early childhood life. Like, mm-hmm. She came in later on life. And came
yeah, she literally shows up when they're kids and says, my son is dead, you're my grandsons, and you're rich now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it just created a shock to the system. And then just being like, I love you, I appreciate how you are, but I want you to have this life that you appreciate.
You can be doing more with your life. And here's how I want you to do that. I mean, and you know, and like I said, I think a lot of people have someone like that. And you can listen politely and say, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, you know what? I'm actually going to keep writing romance novels, but thanks for your input. Just to use an example that totally is not real life. And it's telling that when she meets the twins to tell them they're rich, Rake has a black eye because he got into a fight defending a girl that day. And it's just really, so the twins cannot tolerate bullies. They'll never just stand by, even if it means they get whipped. And that's just always how it's been. And one of the things Rake can't remember before waking up in Venice is he actually thought the heroine was in trouble and went to help her. She didn't need it, but she's like, wow, he can barely stand. He is super drunk and he's trying to help me. This is intriguing to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the heroine. I have to say, like, I love the fact that she had a mission that she was giving back. And at the same time, she was like, she didn't take shit for anyone. Like, she was like, you know, someone was going to hurt her and she's going to hurt him back. Like, she was going to push it. So I found her really well-developed character. What was it so important to show her not just trying to take ownership of her life, but also helping others, like the peeps and the Easter baskets and the...
Yes. And that terrible, terrible orange cake they had to make. My heroine is like Reagan, that she didn't have much when she was younger. But it is. but she didn't have anyone, whereas Rake had his brother and his mother. And then after age 12, he had the money. Whereas Delaney never had anything, orphan, no idea who her family even was, bounced around into and out of foster homes. And she just got really tired of what my late mother-in-law would call holiday Christians, the ones who like donate at Christmas time and don't really think about it the rest of the year. And unfortunately, my heroine sees that as just rank hypocrisy. Like if you really care about orphans, if you really care about, you know, helping people, why do we only see you on Christmas Eve? Mm-hmm. And I'm not slamming that kind of person, but my heroine just won't tolerate it. And so she's just like, unless you're in all year, I don't want your money. I don't want your guilt inspired charity. And so unfortunately she sees Rake as a prime example of that, you know, mm-hmm. someone who doesn't occur to him to like donate all year round, but oh yeah, here's a check for five figures and run along. So although they both have some things in common in their early lives, they definitely went on different paths in terms of, so for Delaney, everything is about getting enough money to set up their own foster system for orphans all over the world. Mm-hmm. And because as a lot of us know, what's in place with public funding often falls short. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't want just, you know, a couple, she wants like a city block devoted to children who are in trouble that isn't necessarily tied down with bureaucratic rules and paperwork. Mm-hmm. And that takes money. That takes a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of patience. So she sees Rake as her paycheck on top of everything else. Mm-hmm. So for them to finally, a big part of that was getting both of them to see the other person had a point. Rake isn't a bad man, mm-hmm. because it doesn't occur to him to do charity work every day of the year. That doesn't make him bad. He's careless. He's a rake. Likewise, Delaney sitting in judgment on people who are giving but not giving according to her schedule, that's not okay either. She's not perfect. Mm-hmm. So a huge part of that was helping the two of them see kind of the holes the other person had. Oh, that could be construed if it's a very sexy romance. You know what? Forget I mentioned holes. We're in a hole-free zone now.
I think they just meet in the middle. I think they just every day they're like, they appreciate each other for what they're doing. And then they realize like, oh, I can either do more, or I can do less, or I can,
yeah, exactly.
More, I can just less, you know? So it just like how neat in the middle.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and Delaney can be understandably bitter about her upbringing, and Ray can be understandably flip about it. So it's like any romance novel, an amalgam of these two people would be a wonderful person. But they're not an amalgam. They're each their own person, and that's how it has to be, and that's what you have to work with.
Yep. So what books are you working next?
Oh, well, I'm starting my third book in my werewolf, my foster were trilogy, Big Bad Bear Boyfriend. Okay. I love the titles. The second one, which I just finished, is called the Wolf Next Door.
Oh my God.
And that's set in the same same universe as Bears Behaving Badly, which came out March 31st. Which is again, it's social workers who have all their charges are shapeshifters. So it's funny. So it's kind of like how I thought of Betsy the Vampire Queen. Why are all these vampires old Scottish lords, old rich Scottish lords? Where are the plumber vampires? Where are the secretary vampires? Yeah. Well, this case was, why are all the, you know, what happens when a werewolf is orphaned? What happens? I wanted to do a setup where there actually was an answer to that question. So that is, that's what I'm working on right now. And I'm going to be starting a sequel to Contemporary Asshat. Contemporary Asshat at the court of Henry VIII is about a time travel who meets Henry and Queen Catherine and Queen Anne Boleyn. What I want to do is a trilogy, two queens a book. So next up would be Jane Seymour and Anne of Cleves. I can't wait. I'm sorry. I'm so excited. And like I said, and I get to promote, the last two books in this trilogy, which is so exciting. And like I said, August and then this fall. So there's going to be just a ton of MJ Davidson, and you should be resigned and no one should fight it.
Yeah, I am so excited. So now let's go to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity to share with our audience what they should read next. So what are your favorite genres?
My favorite what?
Genre.
Oh, genre. Okay. I thought you said yarn. I'm like, well, I like a good wool skein. But honestly, I prefer the polyester blends. I did not foresee this question coming. Ironic, I read everything. I'm super eclectic. And so I will read, when I was younger and living with a roommate, I would come back from the library and I would have a cookbook and true crime and romance and the Little House on the Prairie books and European history. And my roommate would just be like, God, you're so eclectic. It's weird. So I like a little bit of everything. I like horror. I like romance, obviously, paranormal romance. Yeah. Big Charlene Harris fan, obviously. Big Christine Feehan fan, obviously. And true crime. These days, as I get older, I get way more into European history. I'm a huge Tudor file, and then Tudors led me to the Plantagenets, which was Henry VIII's mother, and the Wars of the Roses, which I just found incredibly fascinating. And my interest goes all the way up to Edward VIII, the man who the king who abdicated for Wallace Simpson. And then after that, I'm really not interested in anything that's happening over with the British royal family. But and I love, you know, Victoria, who had this really lonely childhood, and they kept her away from court, and she was an only child. Well, she did have a half sister, but the half sister was quite a bit older, so she was gone much of the time. And then this little lonely girl ended up being one of the most powerful women in the world, and no one saw it coming. They was just, I mean, an absurd number of people had to die for Victoria to take the throne, and it was so. That's just complete. I don't know why. It's completely fascinating to me, and I just can't get enough of that stuff. So mostly now it's British monarchy history.
I love it. So what has been a book you read this past year that you love?
Oh, Bears Behaving Badly and Contemporary Asshat. I mean, I know, but I wrote this, The Love Scam, I wrote last year. So that doesn't count. I promise I'm promoting this book, but this year. Yeah. So, and like I said, this is Contemporary Asshat's my first historical fiction. Mm-hmm. So I just love the chance to get to it. And she's disgusted by Henry VIII. She knows everything that's going to come down, but she has to be sweet to this guy. She has to stay on his good side. And she keeps finding mistakes in the timeline. She's like, well, that doesn't happen. Catherine of Aragon doesn't raise an army and go against Henry to take that never happens. So she's got to talk Catherine of Aragon out of doing that. And so she's a nobody from Wisconsin, an expat now living in London, and finds herself back in 1525 at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. And everything from there, it just gets nuttier and nuttier. And it was so fun. And not just the research for the buildings, the food. I get to research all the really delicious, people's English cuisine gets a bad rap undeservedly. And some of the things they got to eat back then, I mean, they were a little light on the roughage, but if you're a carnivore like me, I was just like, oh, wow, I would love a side of pork with my boar and my cow. Thank you very much. It was just so exciting and so fun. And the research for it, Hever Castle, where Anne Boleyn grew up, and before they sent her to France and all that happened after that, and the Tower of London, Westminster Abbey, Windsor Castle, where you're literally standing where Henry VIII is buried. I mean, it's just astonishing to me. It was so fun. And again, I'm so fortunate that I get to do stuff like this. And if readers like you have like half as much fun reading the stuff I have out this year as I had writing it, everyone's going to be happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was just like fun. It was like a fun, quirky, just like did you escape? Like you just got out of like a funk. Like I read it in the pandemic, which is like a weird time to read. And it was just
I'm getting so much. I'm very fortunate to hear from readers pretty regularly. But lately it's been, I've actually, and they're rereading my older stuff. So it's been, I just reread your Alaska trilogy, or I just reread the Betsy book, and it's just really nice to, you know, I write funny. I can't not do that. I'm ridiculously immature. If you say butt, I'll giggle. And if you say fart, I will think that's hilarious. And that's fine. And my work is just, it's just funny. It's light and it's fun, because you don't always want a turkey dinner with all the trimmings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just want cotton candy. Sometimes you want a Hershey bar, and that's fine. Yeah. But, what humbles me is I'll hear from, you know, I take your books to chemo. Mm. I take your book to dialysis.
Yep.
I heard from a reader whose best friend had been raped, and she turned around to my books and she said she was laughing through your book. It was the first time we'd heard her laugh since the trial. Mm. I mean, how do you read that with anything but pure humbleness? And you're just grateful that I just wanted to write funny stuff. I never thought beyond that. When 13-year-old me writing short stories and keeping her head down in class, I just wanted to write funny stuff. I never thought past a publishing contract. Mm-hmm. So to hear from people who are going through these terrible times in their lives, knowing that I've lightened the load a little, mm-hmm. is so nice. And now these days I'm hearing from people in the pandemic, you know, just wanted to say you really gave me a lift, or, you know, I just got your new book and, you know, I just couldn't stop laughing and thank you so much. And I'm stuck in my house with my wife and kids, or my husband and kids, or even I'm just by myself with my cat and I'm lonesome. And I feel better now that I've read your book. I feel like I have a friend, and that's so humbling and wonderful. And I love that they had the confidence and the kindness to share that with me.
I love it. So tell us where you can find you online.
Oh, the online. Okay. Well, I'm ubiquitous. I am everywhere. You can find, there's my website, maryjanicedavidson.org. Mm-hmm. I'm on amazon.com, bnn.com. If you have a local bookstore, you can call them up and they'll order it. And then if they have curbside pickup, so you can support a local, but you don't have to go to Amazon if you don't want to, you can support a local bookstore. Mm-hmm. I actually get a kick out of finding my books in Half Price Books, because I'm of two minds. First I'm like, oh, that's awesome that it's here and people can get it. And then it's, somebody had to get rid of it for it to be here. I don't know how I feel about that. So, and libraries, I just brought a ton of my book. I get 50 author copies per book, which is crazy. I know how they all end. And so I'm dropping them off at local libraries. They'll do, so you can go to your library. They'll do a curbside pickup. At least in Minnesota, the Dakota County Library System does curbside pickup. You tell them what you want, and they'll have them outside for you, and you can get your library books. So my books are everywhere. I am everywhere. There is no escaping me. Be resigned.
I love it. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My Mr. Burns, you know, yes. Let me tell you more about where you can find my books.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
No, thank you. I'm sure you deeply regret now all of it. And I did warn you that you would. And so really you're to blame here for everything. So, and I feel confident saying that.
Not really. If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, or rate and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Want to join a romance loving community? Want weekly book recommendations, monthly author Q&As, and book recommendation meetups? Make new friends, then join our Patreon community. To sign up, please follow the links in the show notes. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more, or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.